This is The Takeaway for Friday, January 26th, 2018.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's great to have you here with us on this Friday. I have Tom Lobianco with me, national political reporter covering Trump, Russia, and the White House for the Associated Press. Tom Lobianco, what would it mean for the President of the United States to fire Special Counsel Robert Mueller?
Well, I think that would probably set us on a path. I don't know if it's a Saturday Night Massacre style thing, referencing Watergate, of course, but it would probably set us on a clearer path to obstruction of justice charges. Unclear whether or not this is something he might still do.
Ryan Goodman is also here, former special counsel at the Defense Department under President Obama, professor at NYU School of Law, editor-in-chief of Just Security. Ryan, the same question to you. What would it mean if Trump fired Mueller?
So I agree. I think it actually could set in motion the way that Senator Lindsey Graham had put it several months ago.
Any effort to go after Mueller could be the beginning of the end of the Trump presidency.
And, you know, I think the question this raises in terms of the news of the day is he did order Mueller to be fired. So in some sense, he already did cross that line. If those folks on the Hill thought that him actually successfully firing Mueller would be an obstruction of justice or an abuse of power, he certainly attempted to do it, it looks like.
Tom, Ryan, stay with us for just a minute. I'm going to come back to you. Folks, 9 months into the special counsel investigation into the Trump team's connections to Russia and possible obstruction of justice, the president says he's happy to meet with the man he reportedly ordered fired in June and to do it under oath.
I'm looking forward to it, actually.
You want to?
Do you have a date set?
Here's a start. Just
do you have a date set,
there's
Mr.
been
president?
No collusion whatsoever. Yeah. There's no obstruction whatsoever. And I'm looking forward to it.
The president's personal attorney, Ty Cobb, modified that statement later. It didn't take long. It wasn't a promise to be interviewed, said Ty Cobb. And let's get back to things now with Tom Lobianco of the AP and Ryan Goodman of NYU Law. Tom, Ryan, I want to get us up to speed on where the investigation stands and also on Capitol Hill, Republican efforts to discredit the FBI and by extension, the entire law enforcement enterprise trying to get to the bottom of connections between Team Trump and Russia. A reminder for listeners, 4 people in the president's orbit already charged with felonies, and some are cooperating, telling what they know. Tom, the president says...
Fake news, folks. Fake news.
What's your message?
Typical New York Times fake stories.
A reenactment, potentially, you mentioned it, of Nixon's Saturday Night Massacre of 1973 during Watergate, only to back off when White House counsel Don McGahn threatened to quit, Tom. Red lines for Republicans and Democrats on Capitol Hill, who always said that this was the thing that would take the Trump presidency into unsustainable ground.
There's a sort of a, for him at least politically, there's a beneficial dynamic at play right now, which is that they're out of the Capitol for the weekend, and they won't be back till the State of the Union. So less chance for us to get some, you know, clear answers out of them. Now, that said, how much staying power does this have? You know, we need to find out at this point whether or not the folks like Lindsey Graham, like Tom Tillis, a senator from North Carolina, who originally proposed some of the special counsel protection language when these reports of Trump trying to fire Mueller first came out over the past summer, whether they still feel like it's a real threat at this point.
Ryan, in Davos, the president says this is New York Times fake news that he tried to fire Mueller in June. I want to play you some tape from June from Chris Ruddy, who's a friend of the president's, CEO of Newsmax Media, conservative media company, and also April Ryan, reporter with American Urban Radio Networks.
I think he's considering perhaps terminating the special counsel. I think he's weighing that option.
One of my sources reached out to me just before we went on air, and they said there's mass hysteria in the West Wing about this. We don't know if it's going to happen or if it won't happen.
Ryan, both of those voices from back in June, the very moment when the president says reports that he was firing Mueller was fake news, those are contemporaneous people saying at the time it was true.
It's another indication just retrospectively we can now look back with evidence that we have of the kind of a concerted effort to lie to the public and the media. He wasn't just considering it. He actually tried to do it. And this isn't just the New York Times, but it's now the Washington Post and NBC all corroborating independently the report that he actually did try to get his White House counsel to ask the Justice Department to fire Mueller.
Tom, we've also learned that the president allegedly asked then-acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe in a meeting who he voted for Given his demand for loyalty from James Comey, FBI director, before firing him, what are the potential implications of that report?
And that's the type of thing that all builds into whether there is obstruction of justice, whether he's trying to interfere in this investigation. That, you know, has been going into his own campaign now for, you know, a year and a half. I mean, we'll be coming up on 2 years pretty soon. Obviously, this is probably a question more for legal scholars, folks with some actual legal training like Ryan. But everyone's talking about what is obstruction of justice, what counts as obstruction of justice. And the reason that we're talking about that is because those are the types of questions that Mueller is asking witnesses. He wants to know information about the firing of Comey. He wants to look at what happened surrounding the firing of Michael Flynn, the crafting of the statement after the June 2016 Trump Tower meeting was revealed. All of these things have to do with whether the truth is being told, whether it's being manipulated. Are you manipulating investigators? Are you trying to obfuscate? These are all questions surrounding obstruction of justice. Do they get obstruction of justice? Do they ultimately decide that is where they want to land in this? We don't know that answer yet, but it's certainly where they seem to be headed.
Ryan, you are the legal mind that Tom is looking for here. It turns out Andrew McCabe voted in the Republican primary in 2016 and did not vote in the presidential election. I don't know if he answered the president's question. From the legal perspective, the president questioning McCabe in this way, we should add that other Justice Department officials, Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, lots of people have already been questioned under oath by Robert Mueller.
It does, exactly as Tom said, go to the question of obstruction of justice. And the key element for obstruction of justice is the corrupt intent. That's actually the wording in the law. And here, the problem for the president will be if he tried to impede the ongoing investigation because he was trying to stop them from detecting and prosecuting wrongdoing on his part or on the part of his family or inner circle.
Well, let's take this story now to Capitol Hill and talk about some of the allies of the president, some of the Republican congressmen who are operating there.
Release the memo.
Review the memo.
Not only have I seen the memo, but as a member of the Intel Committee, I've been aware and have been helpful in creating this memo.
Shocking memo circulating in Congress.
Everybody wants to see the memo.
Release the memo.
By releasing the memo.
We ought to see the memo.
When are we going to get the memo?
Tom LoBianco, the memo, they're saying they want to release the memo. It's become a hashtag on social media. A major campaign around this. This centers around Republican Congressman Devin Nunes, the Republican chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. Nunes has a memo that conservatives are waiting for. It has text messages from FBI agents. It has FISA implications. What is it?
Right. So everything that we know about this is it appears to stem from Devin Nunes's, I guess what you could best call a counter investigation into allegations that Trump aides had been illegally surveilled by the Obama administration. You really saw him start to ramp it up after he removed himself from the Russia investigation. Really goes back to this, by all accounts, an erroneous tweet by the president where he accused Obama of directly wiretapping him. There's no evidence to that effect. This is part of that gelling of the counter-narrative. I think what was fascinating about this is that a lot of the stuff beforehand we had seen confined to members of the House Intelligence Committee, a few Republican national security types, you really saw a more widespread approach to messaging it. I think that's pretty telling of where things are now. Remember, now this comes in concurrence with the House Intelligence Committee, the Senate Intelligence Committee, coming towards a head, really. So I think that you see the counter-investigation, the counter-narrative ramping up at exactly the same time that you see both of these investigations coming to a head.
Officials at the Department of Justice, including Trump political appointees, have publicly asked Nunes not to release this memo, saying it would be damaging to the FBI, it would be damaging to national security. These are political appointees from the Trump administration. One of the concerns here, Ryan Goodman, is that what the memo has to say about FISA warrants or the FBI will be selectively culled, will be cherry-picked, and won't paint a complete picture of FISA warrants or a complete picture of the FBI that, frankly, a lot of people would like to have.
That's right. It's very selective, apparently, from all reports about the memo. And therefore, it both compromises sources and methods, and that's what I think the FBI is very concerned about. And at the same time, to rebut the memo, one would have to dip further into classified information. So it disables people from being able to, who know about the true information, to be able to come forward with it so that the public will never get a clear picture if, in fact, this memo is released in the fashion in which they're trying to do so. But I'm not even sure that they're trying to necessarily release it. The fact that they won't even share it with the FBI or the Senate suggests that this really is political gamesmanship.
But if they're not trying to release it, then what are they trying to do? I mean, if we get to this point next week and release the memo has not been satisfied, won't there be a lot of unsatisfied people?
I think there are two paths that they might be on strategically. One is that the memo never gets released, so it's just part of it feeds the conspiracy mill that there's something deeply wrong and corrupt inside the FBI. They're anti-Trump. They were pro-Clinton. The other is that the memo gets released, and then it's just this extraordinarily biased, selective application of or information about some parts of these episodes. And if it's being written up, as people have said, like talking points from Nunes's staff, it's deeply problematic. Nunes was supposed to be recused from the Russia investigation. What's he doing writing a memo? Nunes was on the Trump transition team. He has kind of an original conflict of interest. So this really is playing politics with national security.
Tom, I know that AP reporters aren't in the business of making too many predictions, but I'll try. Can you predict a partisan firestorm next week or the week after?
Well, in this one, yeah, I think that's an easy prediction, yes. I think the bigger question is, when does it end? There's sort of two levels of this. You know, on the one hand, there's a lot of partisan bickering on the surface. And, you know, that's easy. We see that all the time. But just below the surface, I think you have folks who are concerned that they want a serious investigation done. This is the credibility of their institution at stake here. It is a historic investigation. So I think there's a little bit more seriousness than we see on the surface.
Ryan, we're going to run, but I want to ask you before we go, do you subscribe to the idea that the news that the president moved to fire Bob Mueller back in June, that those leaks must have come from White House personnel and that the reason it's leaking now is that someone in the White House is worried that he's going to try to do it again?
For me, I think that is the most plausible explanation, that the information is coming from somebody in the White House. I'm not quite sure why. I'm not sure whether it's because somebody there is worried that this might turn again towards the president wanting to fire Mueller, or it's instead somebody worried just about their own reputations, and they're trying to get out to the media quite a favorable interpretation of how they behaved. And of course, one of those people might be the White House counsel. So I do think it's coming from the White House, and I don't know whether or not it's because there's an imminent threat once again against Mueller's survival.
That's Ryan Goodman, professor at the NYU School of Law, editor-in-chief of Just Security, and a former special counsel at the Defense Department. Ryan, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Tom Lobianco of the Associated Press, national political reporter covering Trump, Russia, and the White House. Tom, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Babbel, a language app that teaches real-life conversations in a new language like Spanish, French, and German. Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons are available in the App Store or online at Babbel, Babbel.com. This is The Takeaway from WNYC and Public Radio International in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston.
Thanks for being with us this hour. I'm Todd Zwillick, and it's been a year since President Donald Trump became president. And ahead of his State of the Union address next Tuesday, we've been looking at the policies and the strategies that have defined this first year in office. We've looked at the economy, we've looked at national security, and one way the president is reshaping government is through executive orders. David Dayan is a contributor to The Nation and The Intercept, and he's reviewed all of President Trump's 55 executive orders from 2017 for The Intercept. David says these orders and the deadlines attached to them make it clear what was presidential talk and what was action.
In 2017, President Trump ordered 95 different deadlines, and many of those were reports to the president, but they were also orders to continue or end a particular action or publish something in the Federal Register or on an agency website.
I can think of one when you say a deadline. The president said he would rescind the DACA program for young undocumented immigrants, but not until March. The idea there was to give Congress 6 months to figure it out.
Right. That's an example. And there were certain deadlines around the travel ban. You know, these executive orders, you think about them as, and certainly I think the president wanted people to think about them as him committing actions, changing policies and things like that. But a lot of them were sort of writing the blueprints for policies that may or may not be changed later. And so the sort of the outer limits of what you could do with some of these executive orders was just order a report from one of the federal agencies, whether it's Treasury or Homeland Security or Interior, whoever, and then have them make a recommendation, perhaps, that could be carried out by the president or maybe not, and it might require Congress.
So the president does frequently tweet about unprecedented action in his administration. You're right about that. He likes to advertise a lot of action. A lot of them are in the form of executive orders. What kinds of policy changes, though, do they telegraph if they're coming in a few months or laying the blueprints, as you say, for action later?
Yeah, I mean, it really runs the gamut, whether it's immigration policy or trade policy or regulatory policy or incidents around national monuments and whether or not to shrink them. There are this host of reports, and it's really sort of the building blocks for executive action on a whole host of fronts. And what we wanted to do with this project is see whether those reports, A, were getting done at all, and B, if they were, if they could be made public so that the public would know sort of what these steps that were being taken on the part of the administration were. What we ended up finding is that only about half of them were able to be confirmed as completed, about 48 of the 95 that were deadlines in 2017 actually made it, and some of those were late. The other 47 were not met at all to any of our knowledge, and far less of them were actually made public.
Well, ordering reports is fine. David, I wonder which executive orders you think have been the most consequential at the moment the president signed them. Certainly, there was a lot of attention, and rightfully so, on the travel bans. Those came from executive orders, right? Would you say that those were the most consequential orders of 2017, or were there others?
Yeah, I would say those, the travel ban orders, which involved a host of different policies around refugee resettlement and visas for these majority Muslim countries, was both the most consequential and the most contentious, because as we know, it's still being determined in a court of law at the Supreme Court level. They're still trying to figure out whether or not it was constitutional to carry this out. One that I think should have been the most consequential but wasn't was the installation of this National Commission on Opioid Abuse. And that had a very specific policy goal to create a report that then would create recommendations that the president could act on. Those reports, while late, did get done. What ended up happening is the president did belatedly declare that national emergency, but offered no funding behind it. So here we are a year into the presidency, and this terrible scourge that has killed tens of thousands of Americans, almost nothing has been done really at the federal level except for the writing of this report, whose recommendations have largely not been acted upon. And so that's a good example of these executive orders that could have been quite consequential, but the follow-through has been somewhat lacking.
How important is the executive order now to President Trump at a moment when Congress is especially dysfunctional, has trouble agreeing on almost anything, and probably won't shape up in the next couple of years?
Well, you're absolutely right. In a time of legislative gridlock, the executive order becomes something that, you know, is a possibility for advance and progress, not just for Trump, but for any president. You know, President Obama said famously that he was going to use his pen and phone, and the pen would be writing the executive orders and signing them. Certainly, Trump, many of these executive orders were in the first couple months of the administration. He really front-loaded them to give the appearance of forward motion. The problem is there just hasn't been that kind of follow-through that really made these things move. I would say there was sort of maybe there's one area in which there was a lot of follow-through, and that was on regulatory policy, both sort of neglecting the enforcement side of certain regulations and then moving forward to either cancel or delay the start time or outright change various regulations. And a lot of that was embedded in these executive orders, which commanded the agencies to sort of move forward on deregulation.
We should remember, David, that one of the liabilities of the executive order, look, they can provide a great photo op and they can result in important policy changes. They can also be reversed by the next executive order. The next president can simply undo them, and often do.
Absolutely. And certainly we see a sort of lack of durability around the executive orders. Trump has certainly used these to signal sort of a change in direction from his predecessor, President Obama, to this administration. And the next president can do exactly the same thing and probably will.
David Dayan, contributor to The Nation and The Intercept and author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. David, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
This week marks 45 years since the Supreme Court issued its ruling in the landmark abortion case Roe v. Wade, 1973. Last Friday, we heard from Professor Michelle Obermann, who uses her research on abortion bans in places like Chile and El Salvador to challenge people on both sides of the abortion debate here in the United States and to imagine a real world where abortion is illegal.
The abortion tribalism that we're living in, where our focus on legality is really the be-all and end-all, is astonishingly naive. We need to start asking ourselves what we think will happen if abortion is illegal. And both sides need to be having that conversation because it matters. I mean, it's naive to take a political election and have it turn on who announces that they're going to make abortion illegal without asking, and then what?
Well, in 2010, writer Lainey Zumas asked herself a similar question, which ultimately led her to write the new novel, Red Clocks.
In 2010, when I started writing Red Clocks, I was also dealing with infertility in my own life. And I started researching IVF, in vitro fertilization, which is something I eventually did. And I now have a 5-year-old son who was conceived using IVF. And in my research, I came upon this thing called the personhood amendment or the personhood movement, which I hadn't really heard about before. And it started making me feel really angry, really scared, this idea that a vocal small minority of people in our country wanted to give a single-celled zygote rights of life, liberty, and property. So I started to imagine, how would it feel if the scientific technology that enabled me to have my little boy were suddenly illegal? And on the flip side of that coin, of course, you know, across the funhouse mirror from that question was, how would it feel if abortion were illegal again?
And in terms of in vitro fertilization, the personhood law in your book means that an embryo is a person and therefore can't consent to being frozen or put
yes.
in a test tube or being moved, essentially.
Exactly. That would infringe upon its rights to sort of be where it wanted to be, I suppose.
And what's the upshot of that for you or for the characters in your book?
Well, you know, one of the things that I think fiction can do is allow us to really immerse ourselves in imagining the lived consequences of a law, right? So that you can look at something like the Personhood Amendment or the overturning of Roe v. Wade in political terms or abstract terms, but what does it feel like to be a 15-year-old girl who has been impregnated by a classmate she barely knows, facing the choice of becoming a criminal or going forward with a pregnancy that she doesn't want? How does that feel on a daily basis? You know, what is the ordinary kind of human experience of that pressure? And so in charting the lives of the five women in this book, each of them has different kinds of pressures upon her, not just her body, but her mind, her emotional landscape. And that was what was compelling to me, is to imagine what it feels like to live under this law.
You're within the personal lives of your characters in this book, but also sort of in the political life of an America where abortion is illegal, Lainey. And America is talking a lot about walls right now, the wall
yeah.
President Trump wants to build between the United States and Mexico. Your book has a wall, but it's not a physical barrier as much as an ideological one, and it's with Canada.
Yes, it's the Pink Wall. And it stems from an agreement the Canadian government has made with the U.S. government that any woman who wants to go into Canada to seek either an abortion or advanced fertility treatment will not only be turned back, but she can be arrested and sent back for prosecution in the States.
President Trump made a comment during the campaign, I think on MSNBC, talking to Chris Matthews, that gave a lot of pause to a lot of people in the abortion debate.
Do you believe in punishment for abortion? Yes or no? As a principle?
The answer is that there has to be some form of punishment.
For the woman?
Yeah, there has to be some form.
10 years?
I don't know. That I don't know. That
why
I don't
not?
Know. I don't
you
know.
Lainey Zumas, the future president of the United States, saying there has to be some punishment for the woman. Now, he later revised that comment, but still it sent immediate shockwaves through American culture. Even anti-abortion rights activists hesitated to support that remark. What was your reaction?
Aside from horror and rage, I think that it's interesting that not only did Trump say that, but there was a poll taken soon after his election that showed almost 40% of his supporters thought women seeking abortion should be punished. And again, it could be a chicken or egg question. Is he saying it because his supporters say it or vice versa? But the fact is that he's not the only politician who has said something like that. You know, there's a guy in the Idaho Senate, a Republican named Dan Foreman, who actually proposed a bill that would put women who have abortions on trial for first-degree murder. And again, the laws in my book, are in Red Clocks, around punishing women, punishing their bodies, punishing their selves, they really stem from what things that actual politicians have said, especially since 2008, which is when I think the personhood movement emerged as a more kind of vocal and militant sort of grassroots movement in our country. There are politicians currently in office who do think that women should be punished in this way. And the interesting thing to me is that women are already punished in all sorts of ways for having to deal with an unwanted pregnancy, whereas the other half of that unwanted pregnancy, the man who impregnated the woman, does not get punished in the same way at all.
Having imagined this world where embryos are persons and abortion is illegal, what is the effect, the spiritual effect on the women in your story when they lose this measure of control?
The spiritual effect of being told, we think so little of your life that we are going to force you to do something you don't want to do so that this group of cells that could one day become an individual person can keep on growing. I think it's devastating.
Lainey Zumas is the author of the new novel, Red Clocks. Lainey Zumas, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Todd.
On Thursday's show, Jessica Bennett of the New York Times and Coebec of Jezebel talked about consuming art and pop culture in the Me Too era. But what about historical images so ubiquitous that they've become pop culture themselves and shaped our view of history?
One of the images that I think about a lot in this climate is the very famous image of Greta Friedman, who died last year. Well, 2016, she passed away. And she is that very famous woman that you have seen on postcards who is in a nurse's uniform, and she is being dipped into a kiss by a sailor.
That photo was taken in Times Square, August 1945, as news spread that Japan had surrendered. World War II was over. Celebration broke out in the streets, and a photographer captured that iconic moment. But the photo has a backstory that a lot of people don't know. And today, to Koa and Jessica, it feels more relevant.
This image has really been treated as emblematic of true love, true romance. I always see it pop up on Valentine's Day. Mm-hmm. Yet the language that this woman describes in this moment that was shot by another photographer who saw the encounter is actually really scary. The language that she used to describe this before she died was, it wasn't my choice to be kissed. The guy just came over and grabbed. I did not see him approaching, and before I knew it, I was in this vice grip. You don't forget this guy grabbing you. That man was very strong. I wasn't kissing him. He was kissing me.
This was discussed in this woman's obituary.
Yes,
which
it
came
was.
Out a couple of years ago
in the New York
Times. That was the first that I had ever heard this backstory.
This is also a woman who is of a very different generation, which I try and exercise a lot of empathy for, and that they were raised to think about assault and abuse in a really normalized way, and to constantly be aware that it would happen, that it was normal that it would happen to you, and that it should always be flattering. But her entire experience of that photograph is lost. And we have this photograph of this man dipping this woman over mm-hmm. with both of his hands on her, and we have assigned it this romantic mm-hmm. narrative.
Yeah, the most romantic.
The most romantic. Without any consideration of her and the fact that she doesn't know this guy, that she was walking, that she was grabbed.
And she didn't even realize she was in the photo until many years later.
Jessica, what do we do with images like Greta's?
I do think to some extent, you know, I bet that that image is shown in history books. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm pretty sure it is. But the backstory is not. So one thing that we can do is try to bring in these counter narratives that mm-hmm. tell the different story, that explain what really happened. Because so often now, I think we're getting underneath the surface. We are pulling back the layers. We are figuring out what was really going on behind the scenes. And so the more we can integrate those actual real stories and the nuanced stories with the romance narratives, the better off we will all be.
Jessica Bennett and Koa Beck on that iconic American image, the World War II sailor kissing the woman, Greta Friedman, in Times Square, who, by the way, was not a nurse. She was actually a dental assistant. With this backstory of her experience, do you see that iconic American photo differently now?
This is Ken Marish from Wellington, Florida. My opinion of the picture doesn't change. Context is everything. The likelihood that any woman in that time and place would object to being grabbed and kissed by an overjoyed sailor is zero. The possibility of that sailor being a pervert taking illicit advantage is hard to imagine. I still see that photograph as one of the all-time greatest news photos, documenting joy, not assault.
Hi, this is Karen. I'm calling from Austin, Texas. Yes, it does change how I view the photo. From an outsider's perspective, everything looks normal. But when men are, in this case, quite literally covering women's mouths, we'll never know what's really happening. If people want to argue that the kiss was an act of celebration, then that's another case of when a man's feelings take priority over a woman's.
This is Nina from Weymouth, Massachusetts. I think in times of extreme jubilation at such a momentous occasion as the end of a war, I think it's okay if a stranger were to grab a kiss from someone. And I also want to say that as far as Me Too goes, it's unwanted sexual advances, and a man doesn't know that it is unwanted unless he makes an advance and the woman says no.
Weigh in by tweeting us at The Takeaway. Is there value in reexamining a piece of history in this way, or does it stand on its own? We want to hear from you. And to see the image, you can go to our website at thetakeaway.org.
Have you ever seen a commie drink a glass of water?
What?
Why do you want a little bit? Because if you're going to drink, I'd rather you do it in the house.
Why do you think I'm calling you? Just to say hello?
Did you see the memo about this?
And you won't be angry?
I will not be angry.
This is healthy. This is good.
Any movie montage that has young Frankenstein is just fine with me. Thank you, Control Room, here at The Takeaway. It's Friday Movies. Rafer Guzman, film critic with Newsday, is here. Hey, Rafer.
Hey, Todd.
I will not be angry. Thank you, Gene Wilder. God, I love it so much. You got two films for us, Rafer. We're going to do trivia at the end, so we'll leave a little bit of time with that. I defer you to the end of the segment here. Den of Thieves is your first movie, Rafer. Gerard Butler, 50 Cent. O'Shea Jackson Jr. was awesome in Straight Outta Compton.
Yep.
Son of Ice Cube, of course. Nick O'Brien is the hard-drinking leader of the regulators there with the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. Here's a clip.
I am a member of a clique.
It's kind of like being in a gang.
Sort of like a gang, only we have badges, which means you are done. Let me ask you this.
Okay.
Do we look like the types who'll arrest you, put you in handcuffs, drag you down to the station? Hmm?
Not at all.
Right. Exactly. We just shoot you. It's less paperwork.
Oh, that's Gerard Butler, but I have been dying to see what O'Shea Jackson Jr. does next.
Right. He plays a getaway driver in this movie, and it's a really good performance from him. You know, Straight Outta Compton was great. Not a big stretch. He looks a lot like his dad.
Sure does.
You know? This is, you know, a much different role. He's really likable. He comes across really great in this movie. What I liked about this movie is Gerard Butler, who I think when you mention his name to people, most people say, oh, yeah, that guy. Like, you know, what, you know, yeah. Why is he a star again? But I'll tell you, he's really good in this movie. You know, this great, sleazy, kind of unorthodox, but, you know, essentially a good guy, cop. And, you know, this movie came out last Friday. I don't think people expected much out of it, but it was kind of an under the radar success. You know, did a lot better at the box office than people thought, had some really great reviews, including one from me. And so I think it could have legs. It could be like a real sleeper hit.
Den of Thieves might be a great film to see this weekend. I want to turn us around to Maze Runner 3, The Death Cure. Thomas and the Gladers, they have to save their friends, and they have to break into the legendary last city. It's a labyrinth that may turn out to be the deadliest maze of all.
You okay?
Yeah, I think so.
Fry, you good? I think we gotta move now. Enemy!
Rafer, I confess I did not see Maze Runner 1 or 2. Am I going to be totally lost here?
You didn't see those, Tom?
Okay. I tried. Sold out.
I will say what I liked about these movies for this young adult dystopian franchise genre. These were kind of junior league Mad Max to me, and I say that in a good way.
Oh, now I'm interested.
A little rougher than even The Hunger Games or Divergent, and I always liked that about these movies. Not great in terms of sort of emotional connection and really drawing you into the characters. You don't really get to know them that well. There's not a lot driving them, I found. This is a great finale to the series. Even, I would say, a little bit more action in this one, a little bit rougher even than the other ones.
Are you sure it's over?
I'm pretty sure it's over. It seems over to me. You know, and in fact, I would say this might kind of be the end of that whole genre as well. I think this is sort of the swan song, the last we'll hear of the YA dystopian genre.
Really, and as Maze Runner 3, it might be nicer if they could go out on a higher note, but it might be worth seeing if you're a fan of the genre. Rafer, let me give you trivia. Now, I want you to name this film, if you would, based on some admittedly limited but hopefully sufficient audio information. Rafer, name it.
Is that 300?
It is. Gerard Butler, 300 in 2006 in the control room. Cheers. Good job, Rafer. Rafer Guzman, film critic of Newsday.
Thanks, Todd.
No one makes me feel the way you do inside.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick, and you're listening there to R&B singer and piano man P.J. Morton, Grammy-nominated solo R&B singer P.J. Morton, who you might also know as the keyboardist for mega group Maroon 5. Well, P.J. stopped by our studios recently. He sat down and played some music from his first solo album. It's called Gumbo.
Be the way we were when we first began.
Gumbo takes P.J. Morton back to his New Orleans roots. It sprung two Grammy nominations for P.J., one for Best R&B Album, the other for Best R&B Song. For that track, it's called First Began. And along with the sounds of his hometown, P.J. brings some political energy to an album channeled through musicians of the civil rights era.
And, you know, for me, this record, Gumbo, was a pivotal moment the same way What's Going On was for Marvin Gaye. I felt the same way. I felt that I had to say more. It wasn't even that I wanted to, you know. I felt it necessary and a responsibility to say more.
I sat down with P.J. Morton, him at the piano, me alongside on the mic, and we talked about gospel, we talked about politics, and even a little bit about Stevie Wonder.
You know, I'm a preacher's kid, so started in church, like a lot of soul artists, R&B artists. And when I was good enough at 14 and 15, I started playing at the gospel brunch at the House of Blues. A bunch of people came every week, every Sunday, and I would play for some different groups there. And it was really some of the early, besides church, it was like my earliest being in front of an audience, like, you know, seeing how that worked.
And you said that the new album Gumbo is maybe your first chance to say what you want to say with your music. We'll come to that. But, you know, a young musician, 14, even though you were advanced, hanging out with older musicians.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that prepares you for what was in your future, which was not just musical success and an audience. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I don't know if you can call Maroon 5 a supergroup, but this is a band that sold out the arena in my town. I mean, that's sure. that's a different level of performing.
Yeah, I mean, we've performed in front of audiences where I couldn't see where the audience ended, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. But playing in front of hundreds of thousands of people didn't prepare me for recording with Stevie, right. You know what I mean?
PJ, I got you here at the piano. Would you just play a couple of bars of what you played with Stevie Wonder?
Sure.
Yeah, just give us a little bit.
It's a song called Only When It Goes. Pretty sure I don't need anything else. This is the best feeling I've ever felt. I know it took a long time, but now I'm here. And I ain't going nowhere, no more fear. Room full of people, but I only see you. I'm so focused, everything else is in my rear view. Tell me what it's going to take for you to see that I only want to be with you. Say, girl, you know that you're the only one that I want. One that I want, one that I want. You know that you're the only one that I need. One that I need, one that I need.
Yeah. A room full of people, but I only see you.
That's right.
I love that.
Yeah, thank you,
man. I love
that. I still hear it now, and I'm just in awe, man. I mean, it to me, you know, because Stevie is very, very responsible for me wanting to be an artist in the first place. I was a keyboard player who was writing songs and sang, so he was who I looked to as influence.
So we were talking a little bit before, because you're a son of New Orleans.
That's right.
You've been out on the road, of course, for years, but you were in Atlanta, in L.A., here in New York, and now you're back home.
I'm back home in New Orleans. Yeah, I've been home for 2 years now. I kind of thought I'd never move back home, actually. And I just became kind of uninspired. You know, having success with the band is awesome, but I just wanted more. I wanted some purpose, you know, outside of that. So I decided to go back home and you know, started this boutique label, Morton Records, which is also why these Grammy nods are big. It's an independent label that I just started. But I really wanted to give the city something that I didn't have. I had to leave New Orleans to find the music industry and find success in that way, because while New Orleans is so huge on performance and so much talent, there has always been that. There's always been a lack of music business infrastructure, right? So I wanted to move back home and kind of create an environment where we start to make records at home and start to export this charm that we have in New Orleans out to the world. So Gumbo, this album, is just a start in that. But I'm excited about the future of being home and, like, giving back and just really investing in the city and being a part of the fabric of the city.
Did you watch closely hurricane recovery in Puerto Rico? And I ask, of course, as a man from New Orleans.
Yeah, sure.
Everybody always asks people from New Orleans about hurricane recovery, but there's a situation after Maria. I think, I don't know, 40% of people on the island still don't have power. That's the ballpark figure.
Yeah.
It wasn't 60 people that died. It was closer to 1,000,
sure,
according to the best analysis.
Yeah.
Somebody from New Orleans watching that situation has to see something familiar.
Sure, sure. A lot that could have been learned from Katrina wasn't put into action this time, you know, which is the sensitivity. I think it's probably a deeper conversation just of how Puerto Rico is treated, you know, in general. And they're brown people, you know, unfortunately. I'm the guy, I was the only black in my class, right, from kindergarten to eighth grade. Well, actually, second grade, Keith Taylor came, and it was two black people into seventh grade. And I'm the guy who doesn't like to make things about color. You know, I was around all types of people. Obviously, I'm the only black dude in Maroon 5. You know what I'm saying? I don't try to make it about color, but when I like to call things what they are, you know, call a spade a spade. We had tragedies right before that didn't include brown people, and it was just treated differently, you know. But I just think, you know, as Americans, we're supposed to be there for our people, you know. And I know there was a lot of neglect in Katrina, and I just felt like lessons should have been learned from that, and it's unfortunate.
You did a song, I think, last year, Everything's Gonna Be All Right. Was that last year?
Yeah, the album, yeah, on Gumbo, yeah, it came out last year.
Now, you did that with BJ the Chicago Kid, who was nominated for a Grammy last year.
Yes.
I saw in R&B.
Yeah, and I wrote on that album as well.
Well, can I get a few
bars of that? Would you mind?
Everything's going to be all right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
love
sure.
to hear it.
I'll go straight to the second verse because that's what I kind of talk about what's going on here. Let's see. Two steps forward, but 10 steps backwards. Everything's gonna be all right. They're killing us dead like our lives don't matter. Everything's gonna be all right. I can hear you loud and clear. Everything's gonna be all right. And it feels like you don't want me here. Everything's gonna be all right. It will be all right. All right. All right. Yeah, all right. It will be all right. All right. All right. All right. Yeah. All right.
It's really great to have you, PJ Morton. Man, you got the Grammys coming up.
Yes,
right?
Sir.
Two
yes,
nominations.
Sir. That's right.
Maybe you'll have that microphone again if they call your name at the Grammys.
It would be amazing, man. I'm just, I know it's cliche, but I'm super honored just to be nominated amongst these greats in our industry, and I'm excited. Hopefully I win.
PJ Morton, solo artist and keyboardist for Maroon 5. Great to have you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
The Grammy Awards are this weekend, so we'll have to wait and see if PJ Morton takes home a win. In the meantime, you can check out a video of PJ performing in our studios. Just head to our website at thetakeaway.org. You know, some people never change their minds. And that's all for us today. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend and happy Friday to you. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway. You see, I'm still here. Let me adjust my pride. Everything's gonna be all right.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.